Welcome to In the Studio with the 21st Century Perspective on History's Greatest Rock Albums.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One, two, three.
Redbeard here, and today, In the Studio, it's the Cinderella story of the record-setting debut album by an Australian band on its anniversary.
For example, we had the right songs, we had the right sound, we had the right kind of identifiable image that people seemed to like. It was very comfortable. People didn't feel confronted by us, you know. MTV came on the air and we'd done film clips, and film clips had been done in Australia for quite a time before that, you know. There are all these things that kind of made us successful, but, you know, you can say, well, it was because of this, it was because of that, it was because of all those things, but I think more than anything else, it was simply our time. Hi, this is Colin Hay. I used to be in a band called Men at Work, and I'm in the studio talking about my first album, Business as Usual.
When the lead singer of the Monkees, Davy Jones, died recently, I was reminded that their 1966 debut album held the record for the most weeks at number one for a debut in the U.S. all the way until 1982. That's when an Australian pub band, totally unknown outside that country, managed to occupy the number one sales slot in America for 15 weeks. Now, exactly how did that happen? The band was Men at Work, who labored in the thriving pub scene in and around Melbourne, Australia in the late 70s and early 80s. Their eventual unprecedented worldwide success is all the more fantastic when you realize just how hard it was for Men at Work to get noticed in the first place. Men at Work lead singer-songwriter Colin Hay joins me in the studio.
2 years after we'd been going, an A&R guy from CBS called Peter Carpin came to see us. There was actually a guy before that who was just a fan who worked at CBS, a guy called Michael Ware, who used to come and see the band every Wednesday night. And he used to go into the CBS, and he wasn't in a position to sign the band. But he would go into CBS and meetings and board up, you know, like nail people's phones to the tables so that they would, and put Men at Work signs everywhere and close up the car park and put Men at Work signs and stuff so that the powers that be would take notice. But about our band, you know. And somebody came along to see us from CBS, but they weren't really very interested. And then Peter Carpin, who had been in New York, and he came back to Sydney, and he came to see the band, and he offered us a deal. And at that time, there was a guy called Peter McKeon, who ended up producing our first two albums, who was in Australia at the time. So we did one song, we cut one song called Who Can It Be Now, and went to number one in Australia, or number two or something. And then we did the rest of the album. And the album took off in Australia in 81 and different parts of the world in 82. And then the last country to pick up on it was the United States. And then once they did, it kind of went through the roof.
Childhood friend, here they come, those feelings again. Who can it be now?
take me away? Why do they follow me? It's not the future that I can see, it's just my fantasy.
Sung by Men at Work's Colin Hay, that's Who Can It Be Now, from 1982's Business as Usual. Here's Colin.
I think it was almost criminal, as a matter of fact, you know, the original deal we got with CBS, but we were desperate to make a record, you know. So we made a record which Peter McKeon, who is the producer, he recognized straight away was, you know, could be an international record. You know, we were kind of more thinking, oh, well, hope we go number one in Melbourne, you know, or, you know, in Australia. But even then, even we actually felt that, well, okay, you know, it could do well anywhere, you know. He thought, he always kind of felt that it would be very strong in America because we had things within the songs and the band that he felt Americans liked. For example, we had melody and we had my voice, which was kind of, you know, had a kind of a unique thing to it. And we had the saxophone and the flute. There were kind of things that he felt were very, would be very interesting. So he was right. He chopped the songs up. He was very important in lots of ways too, because he actually, for example, Who Can It Be Now used to be 6.5 minutes long, and when we played it live, you know, because we just play away on this groove and then somewhere halfway through the song the hook would appear, you know. And he said, well, the first thing you've got to do is put the hook up the front of the song, you know. I thought, oh, that's a good idea.
Men at Work was formed in 1979 by guitarist Colin Hay and Ron Stryker, quickly gaining a strong local following in the pub circuit around Melbourne. Men at Work struggled for 2 years to land an Australian record deal, according to lead singer Colin Hay.
We had the reputation of being the highest paid unrecorded band in Australia, which, you know, is kind of one of those titles that you go, you know, take with a pinch of salt, but we used to have big crowds come and see us. We had to keep moving from hotel to hotel because the crowds get bigger and they kept spilling out into the street. And so we'd move to another hotel that was bigger.
Yet in spite of early local popularity, Men at Work had no career management direction to exploit it. For instance, Colin Hay admits that their first so-called manager was simply a loyal friend with zero experience.
Farmer, you know, he knew nothing about managing bands. He was my friend and I'd gone through university with him. So I said to him one day, he said, well, if you get the band together, I'll hustle for you. So that was the basis of our relationship, and it stayed that way until we stopped working together. It was always just a handshake deal. So he, you know, he just started off, he didn't know anything about rock music, and we didn't really know how to do it either, you know. So we didn't go through any of the rock industry in Australia, so to speak. So I think that created a lot of resentment as well, because of the fact that all of a sudden we were nobody, and a lot of people had come to see us because we had large crowds that were coming to see us, but no one was really willing to take a chance on us because we were kind of a quirky band, you know. We were kind of playing a lot of different kinds of music. I never had a doubt in my mind that we would be able to, that there was a market, or that there was a, not so much a market, but an audience, because people are people, you know. If you play to an audience in Melbourne, you go across the other side of the world and you play to an audience somewhere else, you know, people dig it. It's just a matter of where you are at that particular time. But people in this country certainly took us to their hearts, you know, in a big way. Because I think that at that particular time also, there wasn't really that much going on, you know, over here as well. You know, there was kind of all those American bands that we couldn't really understand them. We thought they were all the same band. You know, we just thought they changed costumes and put on false beards and big hats. At that particular time, anyway, they all had a very similar kind of sound.
Bad boy, Johnny. Don't you slip up or play the fool. Oh, no, Ma. Oh, no, Da. I'll be your golden boy. I will obey every golden rule. Get taught by the teacher not to daydream. Get taught by my mother. Football with you, John? No? Oh. You must be gonna play cricket this year then, are you, John? Nah, 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 nah. Well, you sure are a funny kid, Johnny. But I like you. So tell me, what kind of boy are you, John?
I only like dreaming all the day long. No one is screaming.
Inversion of Chuck Berry. Men at Work included Be Good Johnny on their Business as Usual initial public offering. This Business as Usual debut spawned two number one singles in America, something never before done with a band's debut, not even by the Beatles. But why and how? Colin Hay returns with me with those answers next. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and hear much more at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard and you're in the studio.
Hi, this is Colin Hay. I used to be in a band called Men at Work, and I'm in the studio talking about my first album, Business as Usual.
And I'm Redbeard. Like the Young Brothers of legendary band AC/DC, Men at Work singer-songwriter Colin Hay had emigrated from Scotland to Australia in 1967 with his family, and they settled in Melbourne, where Colin Hay later found a thriving live music community as the 80s dawned.
Fantastic. It was really good then, the late 70s. It was really good. Disco in the 70s, mid-70s kind of closed down a lot of things, but late 70s and the early 80s was brilliant, with lots of places to play. There was about 50 or 60 live rock venues in Melbourne itself. You know, we made $60 a week each out of it, which was a lot of money in those days. It was the same as the Dole, you know, the Social Security. So if you were on the Dole and you played in a band, you could do okay. You could even have a dinner party and have a couple of bottles of wine in the fridge.
Fried-out combi on a hippie trailhead full of zombies. I met a strange lady, she made me nervous. She took me in and gave me breakfast. And she said, do you come from a land down under, where women go and men wonder? Can't you hear the thunder? You gotta take cover. Buying bread from a man in Brussels. He was 6'4" and full of muscle. I said, do you speak my language? He just smiled and gave me a Vegemite sandwich. And he said, I come from a land down under, where Peter's flow and mentioned her. Can't you hear the thunder? You better run, you better take cover.
Even though their initial single, Who Can It Be Now, contained a straight-up rock 4-4 beat, their second number one hit in America, Down Under, combined a flute line from an early 20th century Australian folk song with a distinctive reggae beat. Since Caribbean reggae emanates half a world away from Melbourne, Australia, I asked Men at Work foreman Colin Hay where that reggae influence originated.
No idea, but it's there, you know. It's soul, you know. Well, I'm not talking about soul in the category that is usually thought of, but I mean it's you know, there's a lot of spirit and there's a lot of soul in everybody if you actually try and get it out, you know. But the kind of third world kind of it's ethnic, really. It was really just the way that Ron and I used to play. It was very, and also, for example, reggae music was very big in Australia. It was very popular and different music. And we used to listen to a lot of different music from all around the world, but it was never really very conscious. It just used to go in and come out at some, you know, it was in us, you know, it came out. And I don't really kind of try and analyse it too much, but yeah, it was kind of like a white soul thing, you know. Australia, because of its isolation, took from everywhere, you know. drew from everywhere, because it was a continent on the bottom of the world. And no, it was very Melbourne, especially Melbourne was always a very hip town musically, and fantastic music community in Australia at that time. But it took a long time before. See, the thing was, there was always great music there, but no one knew how to market it or take it to the rest of the world. Everyone was scared. Everyone kind of didn't know how to do it, you know? Going to America or going to Britain or going to, you know, these places and trying to make an impression over there, you know, people would just either not try, or they would try and they would just be met with, you know, closed doors, you know? And then you had to go there and do it. You know, I mean, AC/DC did that years ago. You know, they just thought, right, we're off, you know, and they left Australia. And they became massively popular in the whole world and probably still are, you know. And they did that long before Men at Work ever took off and became successful in America. The one thing that we did that I don't think other bands did before us, you know, like, was that we had a sound which was kind of peculiar, and it kind of tweaked people's ears a bit. You know, they had the voice and the saxophone, and we sang about things which were identifiably Australian, and that's what kind of set us apart from other bands that had gone before us, you know. Ron Strickett was like the crucial part of the band, really, apart from, dare I say, in myself. I was the most obvious leader, if you like, in the sense that I wrote a lot of the songs, played the rhythm guitars and sang them. But Ron Strickett was the inspirational part of Men at Work. It certainly was for me. He was the person I met that I wanted to work with, you know, and in a sense, our greatest moments together were before Men at Work was formed in 78, when we played music which we thought was exceptional and different and totally and utterly unique, and never saw the light of day, because what I wanted to do was to be in a band, you know, and put a rock band together, because I thought that was a better way of getting across to large audiences or you know, bigger audiences, was to be in a rock and roll band. So we decided to kind of transpose the acoustic music, which was kind of like, it was very different from this, but if I have to think of something to compare it to, it was like John Martin or something, you know, the Scottish guitarist and writer who I'm a big fan of. It was kind of like that. It was very hypnotic and it was very Australian. And Ron Strickett was a brilliant, very inspired guitarist and writer. And he was very unformed, you know, he was very random. And he would have ideas and I would kind of work with him, and I would kind of, he would just inspire me to write songs. And that was the strength of Men at Work.
The other key member of Men at Work's internationally popular sound was multi-instrumentalist Greg Hamm's saxophone and flute, again, Colin Hay.
He was kind of always used to sit on the fence in a way until the band actually became more successful. Then he got committed, you know, not to a sanitarium, although sometimes I think he used to think that perhaps we all should, or he should anyway. But he used to sit in the, you know, he used to just, originally Greg used to come along to the gigs and play, you know, just blow with us, you know, not rehearse. And he was kind of always kind of like the side man in a way, you know. And then once the band started to, you know, become better known and so forth, Greg became more important in the sense that he was more visible. Ron was very shy, and Greg became much more visible, and used to do a lot of the interviews with me and so forth, and became kind of the other most visible person in the band because he played the saxophone and he played the flute.
All right. I see you on
With another Colin Hay composition on Business as Usual, Men at Work proved with songs such as Underground that they had no problem pulling off a bigger, heavier sound live in concert. So why is Men at Work relegated to pop music trivia contests and not one of the legacy bands of the 1980s? We'll ask Colin Hay that question next. For all of your favorite musicians, visit InTheStudio.net and follow In The Studio on Facebook. I'm Redbeard, and you're in the studio with Men at Work's Colin Hay.
Hi, this is Colin Hay. I used to be in a band called Men at Work, and I'm in the studio talking about my first album, Business as Usual.
And I'm Redbeard on Business as Usual's anniversary. By the fall of 1982, it seemed as if this quirky new band, Men at Work, had simply fallen out of the sky. A powerful new pop cultural force had just launched in America called MTV, and they embraced the quirky videos that Men at Work provided, mutually beneficial in establishing them both as new, fresh, and innovative. But what the Americans didn't realize at the time was that the U.S. was simply the last construction site for Men at Work. Here's lead singer Colin Hay.
Yeah, it was step by step, but it was still fast. You know, we formed in 79. We played for 2 years. We got a record deal in 81. And then we could feel the snowball effect happening. Success in Australia and pockets of success in different countries. And then America coming in. We did a tour for a month with Fleetwood Mac at the end of 82. It took quite a long time to hit, really. Towards the end of 82, we did a tour and we played in front of a lot of people for a month. And then we did a few months by ourselves. And then we went home. And actually, I think that before we ever toured America, we'd done the second album. So whilst Peter McKeon was and the band were rehearsing for the second album, we were going, oh, you know, it's doing well in America. You know, it's like the first single's kind of 169, you know, with a bullet or whatever. You know, we're going, oh, terrific, you know. So we had the second album in the can before we ever came here. And the record company, I think, in America wanted to hold off the release of the album. And which was understandable because they hadn't got anything like the full life of the first album. But we kind of, in our stupidity, or not stupidity so much as loyalty to our Australian fans, our first album had been out for a long time, I don't know, a year and a half or something, before we thought about bringing out the second album. So, which is what we did. We brought out the second album too soon in retrospect. But that, you know, then again, it's like, well, that's what happened. You know, but we were very green. We were an incredible shade of green when we first arrived. We were very young, and we were pretty young. We were very naive and we were very green, but we were also supremely confident. You know, we were the underdogs. We were the upstarts. You know, and we could feel it. we could feel it from a long time, you know, for a long time, you know, and you know, it's different coming from there too. We also kind of, you know, we sent up the whole thing as well. You know, it was kind of, that was a kind of way of dealing with it, was not to really treat it like it was a big deal, you know, because in that way you might kind of succumb to that kind of pressure or something, you know. We kind of tended to make light of it. You know, but it's in retrospect when it actually hits you. You know, it's like a couple of years after that when you go, my God, that actually happened. That's when it actually sort of hits home, you know. Because you're in the middle of it, you don't think about it that much because you're just doing it, you know. People would hit us with statistics all the time, and, you know, it was just kind of, we were in a bus, you know, going across Idaho or something, you know, and, oh, you're number one in America and in England. Oh, right, great. Pass the sugar. It was just kind of that. It was that kind of band. It was very hard to get. I mean, we were excited, you know. We were definitely not an over-the-top kind of outfit as far as, you know, that kind of thing was concerned. I mean, we went and celebrated one night. I think we were number one, and we were the only people in a restaurant in New York, you know. And we ended up getting kicked out, you know, because the waiters wanted to go home.
Thank you.
It's a Mistake comes from Men at Work's follow-up in 1983, an album called Cargo. Their record-setting debut, Business as Usual, spent an unprecedented 15 weeks at number one sales in the U.S., spawned two number one singles from that debut, won Best New Artist Grammy Award, and went on to sell more than 15 million copies worldwide. Men at Work are forever on that elite list of landmark first albums, along with legendary bands including The Beatles, Led Zeppelin, The Doors, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Chicago, Boston, and Guns N' Roses. But Men at Work also has the dubious distinction of being on another number one selling debut album list, with Hootie and the Blowfish and Alanis Morissette, talents who, for some reason, could not build on what drag racers call a hole shot, a meteoric blazing start. It's as if Men at Work were somehow eclipsed by their initial spectacular worldwide popularity, coming up too fast, a rock equivalent to what deep sea divers call the bends. Men at Work's lead singer, Colin Hay.
There was a lot of things responsible. At the end of the day, I always think, well, there's something else. There's something else at work here, you know, as opposed to actually human behavior, you know. I mean, it was our time, but we could feel like we were part of this, not so much that we were, you know, causing it. You know, we were very much, you know, at the forefront of what we were doing. But, I mean, we could always kind of feel that, you know, it was like all these little spot fires, different parts of the world, and they all connected up, you know. And, for example, we had the right songs, we had the right sound, we had the right kind of identifiable image that people seemed to like. It was very comfortable. People didn't feel confronted by us, you know. MTV came on the air and we'd done film clips, and film clips had been done in Australia for quite a time before that, you know. There are all these things that kind of made us successful, but, you know, you can say, well, it was because of this, it was because of that, it was because of all those things. But I think more than anything else, it was simply our time, you know, and you have to recognize when it is, you know, and go, okay, that was incredible, that was exciting, I was part of that, and go, wow, that was a fantastic episode of my life. And then go, right, that was what that was, now it's today. It was always, it was never a very happy band in a lot of ways, you know. But I think that when we started off, we all had a kind of a, I think actually the success of the band held the band together for longer than what it would have if we hadn't have been successful. But it was a dream that I had to have as close to a democratic band as possible, which became a myth very quickly on, that actually can happen. You know, well, it certainly didn't happen within that group of people. And I enjoyed it for the most part, but very early on, it was became clear to me that my ideas basically conflicted with other people's in the bands. I wanted to leave Men at Work very early on, in the sense that when the success came, it was already kind of turning into a bit, it was becoming a bit nightmarish, you know. And it was a band made up of very different personalities. And I underestimated the power of the name, actually, Men at Work. And when we finished the big tour, the big successful tour in 83, I said to my manager, you know, I wanted to leave the band, because by that stage, the success hadn't caused a lot of problems, but it had acted as a catalyst to a lot of problems that were already there. And I said, look, I want to leave the band. And he said, well, we all effectively just went our separate ways, really, you know, when we finished touring. But what actually happened was that there were six people in the partnership. It was a partnership of six people, five musicians and one manager. What actually happened was that the rhythm section was sacked by four of us, by myself and Greg Hamm and Ron Stryker and Russell Depler, our manager. You see, the thing was that this person didn't want to work with that person. He wanted to sack him. He wanted to, didn't want to work with him, but he would work with him. It was just awful. It was so ugly and unworkable that I just wanted out. And I didn't care. I didn't particularly want to sack anybody. I wanted to leave. But then again, it was, and in that regard, it wasn't even a band so much as just six men ending a partnership. Do you know what I mean? Like any other business. Not really thinking, okay, this is a rock and roll band and, you know, we won't be able to make any Men at Work records anymore.
We'll be right back. across the floor. If he hears, he'll knock all day. I'll be trapped, and here I have to stay. I've done no harm, I keep it to myself. There's nothing wrong, state of mental health. I like it here with my childhood friend. Here they come.
Live in Brazil. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this.